Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada for a special live stream for today. This is Tuesday, January 28th. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues, John Elmer, Asa Wynn-Stanley, Tamara Nassar, and Ali Abu Nima. Ali, we are just so thrilled that you're out of Swiss jail and you're back in the civilized world. Can you... I don't. Everyone has been. It's been quite a weekend for you and for everyone who loves you. Just your words on this day.
Well, I'm thrilled to be back, and I'm truly overwhelmed by all the love and support. I can't stress that enough. The support has meant the world to me, from you, Nora, from you, John, from Asa, from every member of the Electronic Intifada team, from Tamara, from Maureen, from Omar, from Leah, from Richard, from Michael. Am I missing anyone?
David. My memories.
From David, of course. You all worked so hard for me, and you also kept the publication going. And you're the best colleagues in the world. And I'm grateful also to so many people around the world. And I'm still just learning about like organizations that put out statements, ADC, Amnesty International, Europe, others as well that I'm probably missing. And I don't mean to offend anyone by missing them. And I've heard from friends all over the world. And I'm just saying that because I'm not going to be able to thank everyone personally. So if you're seeing this, I want you to know how much that means to me. It's truly overwhelming. And I know Asa said the same thing a few months back when he had his little run-in with the authorities, who seem not to like our journalism for some reason that I can't fathom. And I just second Asa on that the support means the world to us. And I know that it does to all of us at EI. So, and the other thing I want to say is the most thrilling thing was to come back into the world and see Palestinians, hundreds of thousands, returning home to the north of Gaza, a true, real celebration and victory after they endured so much. Nothing could be better than to see that.
Yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later on. But Ali, everyone has so many questions. I have so many questions. And I know you want to talk about your ordeal. So let's talk about that. And then we'll talk about what happened in Gaza, kind of as a preview to what, you know, we'll dive in more deeply on Thursday's live stream. But it has been just an incredibly historic moment for you, for us, and of course for Palestine. So we'll get into all of that. But Ali, tell us first, why did you go to Switzerland?
Well, simple reason. I was invited by friends and colleagues and activists in Switzerland who invited me to come and give a couple of talks, a teach-in on Saturday. There's a group there, the Palestine Teaching Group, that's been holding meetings with speakers for a long time. And the Palestine Zurich Committee was going to hold an event on Sunday. And that's what it was, just speaking events to meet with people and talk about what's going on in Palestine.
And were you concerned at all before, you know, getting on that plane to Switzerland?
Yes, but the reason we were concerned, of course, people may remember that a few months back, I was banned by Germany, and they had put a travel ban on me that covered the entire Schengen area. That's, you know, more than two dozen European countries. And it includes Switzerland. Even though Switzerland isn't a member of the EU, it is a member of the Schengen area. Now, acting through my lawyer in Germany, we had got that Schengen ban lifted, and we got confirmation of that by letter from the German authorities a couple of months ago. And it was only after that that we went ahead and planned the trip to Switzerland, but still I was somewhat apprehensive that, you know, maybe there would still be something in the system. And so as a precaution, my hosts in Switzerland had connected me with a wonderful lawyer there, Dina Ravel, and I had actually appointed her as my lawyer back in January, earlier in January, I mean, before I even went to Switzerland, just as a precaution in case I had any trouble at the airport. But at no point did any of us imagine anything more than that they might turn me away at the airport. We never imagined things would escalate the way they did. So that was really foresighted of them to connect me with her, because I already had that relationship established.
Yeah. What happened when you got to the airport? We know you were detained for about an hour, but walk us through what happened when you got there.
Yes. When I got to the passport control and handed over my passport, and the officer typed or swiped my passport, immediately I could tell there was something out of the ordinary. He looked at it for a couple of minutes, and then he said, "Please wait, we have to ask you some more questions." And he called another officer who took me to the back, and they just made me wait for a while. They took my passport, and then they came and said, "Mr. Abunima, there's something in the computer we need to check." I said, "What is it?" And they said, "We don't know, there's something we need to check." They went away, they came back, and I kept asking them, "What is it? What's in the computer?" At one point, he mentioned the Schengen Information System, which is the computer system that is shared by the Schengen area. So that persuaded, or that made me think that this was indeed, as I had suspected, some remnant of the German government action against me. They asked me, they didn't really ask me a lot of questions. They only asked me, "How long are you staying in Switzerland?" I said, "I'm leaving on Monday night." They didn't go into any real detail. I was ready to tell them exactly why I was there. I certainly wasn't going to try to deceive them. If they said, "What's your purpose?" I would have told them exactly why I was there. But they didn't ask me any of that. After a while, they said, "Okay, we'll just complete our checks and you're free to enter Switzerland." And they did indeed let me into Switzerland. And I thought that was the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Once you got in, did you feel that everything was okay? Were there any indications that you were, you know, in any danger from being, persecuted by the Swiss authorities at all?
Not initially. It was a unseasonably warm January afternoon in Zurich, which is a really beautiful town. And after I was brought to my hotel in the center by my hosts, I took a lovely walk around central Zurich, along the river and up to the Großmünster and in the little cobbled streets. And then I got back and I had dinner at a restaurant near the hotel with my hosts and with many of the activists in Switzerland who I was going to spend time with over the next couple of days. But while we were at dinner, the NZZ, the Neue Zürische Zeitung, which I'm told is one of the most influential and important newspapers in Switzerland, published an article that we can show now that is that was published on January 24th, that was Friday evening, around 8 p.m. local time, which is when we were having dinner. And this article immediately caused concern for all of us around that dinner table. The headline says, "Once again, a radical Islamist is scheduled to perform in the central laundry in Zurich. The cantonal police are requesting an entry ban." The central laundry is the name of a sort of alternative space. It sounds funny, but that's all it is. And the article says, that since the terrorist attack on October 7, 2023 in Israel, supporters of the Palestinians have appeared publicly around the world. The moderate voices are joined by many who openly sympathize with Hamas and take anti-Semitic positions. And then they say such extremists have repeatedly been given a platform in Zurich. And then they claim that a year ago, for example, a representative of the radical Islamic Samedun group was able to appear in the Central Laundry. Now, as people will know, Samedun is not in any way an Islamist group. It is a left-wing political group that is not in any way Islamist. They say also, and I point that out not to say that that makes them good or bad, but just to show the utter carelessness with the language here and the terminology. And they say the Palestine Committee Zurich had invited people to an event with Ali Abu Ni'meh. He is a Palestinian-American author and director of the online platform Electronic Intifada. Abu Ni'meh and his platform are a mouthpiece for Hamas, says Thomas Patzko. He is a board member of Never Again Now, a nonprofit organization dedicated to combating anti-Semitism. So it's an Israel lobby group.
Yeah.
But this is the paragraph that really caused me concern. It says, the Zurich cantonal police have also become aware of Abu Ni'meh's planned appearance. They have submitted a request to Fedpol, that's the Swiss federal police, for an entry ban. The responsible government counselor and security director, Mario Fair, explained in response to a request from the NZZ, quote, we do not want an Islamist Jew hater who calls for violence in Switzerland. Fedpol confirmed to the NZZ that the Zurich cantonal police have received a request for an entry ban. Due to official secrecy, the authority is not providing any information on specific names or whether the ban has been issued. Fedpol can issue entry bans if a person endangers the internal or external security of Switzerland. So when I read that, I started to be concerned about whether I was now somehow a fugitive in Switzerland. But I stress, I had entered the country through the airport. My passport had been stamped at the airport. I had answered all the questions I had been asked at the airport, and I entered the country lawfully. And but I spoke to some people, and we were concerned, but we thought maybe this is spin from the NZZ. And, you know, in any case, what could we do about it? I wasn't going to just hide in my hotel room.
Right. I mean, I've never heard of a retroactive entry ban being applied. It doesn't make any sense, but this is what they were trying to go for. Can you talk a little bit more about this Mario Fair?
Yeah, person? Well, yeah, he's described as a member of the Zurich cantonal or city council, I'm not sure which, and the security director. And according to this article from the Gray Zone, which was just published today, you can see the headline there, Swiss official who jailed journalist Ali Abu Ni'meh is fanatical pro-Israel activist. And this article from the Gray Zone contains a number of quotes from Mario Fair from speeches he gave, for example, at a rally for solidarity with Israel on October 10, 2023, where he stated, quote, the fate of Israel and its inhabitants is close to my heart. And according to the Gray Zone, before rattling off a comprehensive list of pro-Israel talking points, ranting about Iran and quoting notoriously racist Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir, while demanding the Swiss government cease funding any development projects in Palestine. Quote, this is from Mario Fair, Hamas and its main sponsor, Iran, have always called for the destruction of Israel and the Jews. The fact that official Swiss foreign policy believed in the illusion that it could seriously negotiate with these terrorists is naive and shameful. Anyone who rapes women, kills old people, kidnaps children, dehumanizes the dead, takes countless people, peaceful people hostage, is not a negotiating partner. He's a rapist, a murderer, a terrorist. Golda Meir was right. You cannot negotiate peace with somebody who has come to kill you. Peace will not be possible with Hamas and its accomplices. And they go through more sort of these kind of, you know, mouth-foaming quotes from Mario Fer, which indicate that he basically thinks that all Palestinians are terrorists and all critics of Israel are supporters of Hamas.
I mean, that's incredible projection, because you take all of those qualities that Mario Fer just listed and they apply to Israel, you know, a thousandfold. Let's talk a little bit more about, what happened on Saturday, the day after you arrived in Zurich, the day you were arrested.
Yes. Well, that day I was supposed to do the teach-in at a school in Zurich. It wasn't hosted by the school. The hosts of my event had rented the school premises as a venue. My understanding is they had a contract with the school, that the school knew who I was, that this had been organized well in advance. But on the morning of the event, it was supposed to, the event itself, I think, was scheduled at 2 o'clock. But at some time earlier in the day, one of my hosts had gone to the school, one of the main organizers of that particular event. And he called me and he said, there's a notice pinned to the door of the school, which says the event has been canceled and the staff are demanding the key. Apparently, they'd been given a key to access the school for the event. And my host was waiting for our lawyer, Dina, to come and to give advice. But I wasn't there on the scene, but from my understanding, they must have concluded that holding the event at the school was impossible. And the event was to be moved to another place in Zurich called the old post office, which actually turned out to be a rather amazing, beautiful Bauhaus style building, really quite a stunning architectural piece. But it is actually, as I understood, a squat. So it's under control of, you know, again, an alternative political space that was open. And we were supposed to hold it on the roof of this building, which was an open space. And apparently they were going to get a sound system and we're going to do it there. So myself and one of my hosts, I think I can use first names, Valérie, who is one of the activists there, who had taken me out to lunch. We had had raclette, which is a very Swiss melted cheese dish, and very filling, which was a good thing because it was going to end up being a long day. And then we had a lovely walk from central Zurich up towards the old post office. It was about a 45-minute walk or so. And we were on the phone with our other hosts, and I spoke to one of them, to the main organizer who'd invited me, Blake, and he said, we're here at the old post office and Valerie and I were nearby. And he said, and Blake told me, look, the federal police had gone to the home of one of the activists who were organizing the event on Sunday. The federal police had apparently gone to his home the night before and told him that they did not want me to speak anywhere in Switzerland. And Blake said, it sounds very serious. And I said, well, nobody's notified me of anything. You know, I haven't received any notice from anyone. And Blake said, well, we're at the old post office. Come, you know, we were very close. He said, come over here and we'll discuss it and we'll talk about what to do. So Valerie and I were going down the street. We were under a footbridge, so sort of under an underpass. And all of a sudden, I felt someone grab me. And this guy who had a ponytail and a beard, and I thought, and he was very heavy set, very big. I thought I was being mugged. I thought I was being robbed. And I just instinctively started to push back and fight. It wasn't like a decision. It was just pure instinct. And then I felt several other people grabbing me. And I thought I was being robbed because I was wearing my backpack. I had all my devices with me. And then they started shouting, "Polizei, Polizei, police," and pulling me. And I could see that Valerie was just utterly stunned. And I just looked at him and I said, "Valerie, go tell Blake, go tell Dina, who's the lawyer, that, you know, the police are taking me." They dragged me. They pushed me up against the wall. They handcuffed me with my backpack on. So my arms were kind of stretched far behind me like this. It was quite uncomfortable. And then they dragged me to an unmarked Audi station wagon and threw me in the back in a very awkward position. The handcuffs were very tight. They were cutting into me. And I was just shouting at them, "What are you doing? Why are you abducting me? What are you doing?" They put me in the car and they sped off at like high speed. And I was like, "What are you doing?" They're saying, "You're under arrest. You're under arrest. There's an arrest warrant for you." I said, "I'm under arrest for what? What have I done?" They said, "Be quiet. We will explain everything at the station." I was just utterly stunned. They drove me to the station, which turns out to be this huge new complex that is both a big police station and a prison, into the underground car park. And they take me out and they take me upstairs and they take my backpack from me and they put me in a cell, which was literally 5 feet, about 5 feet by 7 feet, just a concrete box, no window. There was no furniture except like a concrete protrusion from the wall that you could sit on, and they put me in there. I had no idea what was going on. After a while, they came back and they strip searched me, and they said, "You're under arrest." And I said, "Well, I want a lawyer." And they allowed me to access my phone only to give them the name and number of the lawyer, Dina, and they did call her. And I was waiting in that cell for quite a while until they informed me that Dina had arrived and there was going to be some sort of hearing with the police and with Dina there.
And were you handcuffed the entire time? And also, were you injured? I mean, that sounds like an incredibly violent arrest. Were you okay?
I mean, it was painful. It was uncomfortable. The handcuffs did, you know, it was sort of, I mean, now when I squeeze my wrist, there's still some residual pain. And, you know, it did cut into me a bit. I did have some bruising on my arms. But I when I was in the cell, I was not handcuffed. But I mean, you know, you were in a concrete box. It's not like you could go anywhere. And during the hearing, I was not handcuffed, so that was fine. But we were in the hearing was just sort of in an office where there's a table with a big table with a divider on one side, and you and your lawyer on one side with an interpreter, and then the police are on the other side. And it was conducted by one of the officers who had abducted me from the street. So they had sent a team of four people. There were actually four. I saw some reports that said three, but there were four. The first man I saw with the beard and the ponytail, I never saw again once they put me in the car. In the car with me were three other officers who took me to the station, but in the beginning they were four. And he conducted this hearing. They told me it has to be done with an interpreter. because it has to be conducted in German with an official interpreter. And they asked me, do you speak English or Arabic? I said, I can speak either. They said, well, because it's the weekend, it might be hard for us to find an English translator. It's easier for us to find an Arabic translator. And there's a clue there. Why do they have so many Arabic translators on call?
Indeed. Okay, so this was this hearing the same day that you were arrested on Saturday?
No, this, yes, it was the same day, and it was this sort of formal proceeding where they were to read me what it is I was supposedly accused of, and I was to be given an opportunity to respond. Dina, who was with me, the lawyer, Dina Ravel, advised me, as one should typically do in a police interrogation, to exercise your right to remain silent, except for, she said it was, you know, I mean, I don't want to necessarily say what I was advised. I'll say what I chose to do. I take responsibility for what I chose to do. I did answer some questions and I didn't answer other questions. And whatever advice I was given, ultimately, that was my decision. I don't want to reveal the advice. But so I was asked basic questions about my identity. I confirmed my identity, but they asked me a lot of questions about my family, why I was in Switzerland, which I refused to answer. And then they read me what I was supposedly accused of. And these were documents that were presented in German and read to me by the translator. My lawyer was allowed to read them, but was not allowed to take copies. My understanding is that the lawyer can later request copies, but can't take them on the spot. But I do think we now have those documents. And the heart of what I was accused of, and this is, I think, important to understand the connection between what we saw in that NZZ article and what they alleged. And so, and this is a rough translation, and I take responsibility for any inaccuracy in the translation. But basically, they said that due to the current events in the Gaza Strip, there is an increased risk of radicalization and violent extremist or terrorist motivated attacks, as was already manifested in an attack on a Jew by a jihadist motivated lone perpetrator in Zurich in March 2024. And for that reason stated above, on 24 January 2025, the issuing authority issued an entry ban against the person concerned, which is me, on the basis of Article 67, paragraph 4 of whatever the Swiss code is, in order to safeguard the internal and external security of Switzerland, and that this ban has been advertised in the National Automated Police Search System by the responsible authority, and that the person affected, meaning me, by the measure must be heard in advance in accordance with Article 30, paragraph whatever of the law, unless the order for the measure cannot be postponed because waiting would result in predominant disadvantages and therefore imminent danger. And that is actually very similar language to the ban that was issued. I'm giving my opinion here. I'm not quoting any lawyer. But the bans that were issued against me in Germany, they said something similar, that normally there would be a hearing unless the threat and danger is so grave that it has to be implemented without a hearing. And that's what they did in Germany, and that's my understanding of what they did here in Switzerland. And in the documents that were on the table in front of me during this hearing, I could see many of my tweets quoted. I don't have copies of those documents. I wasn't allowed to take notes. Obviously, we couldn't photograph them. But I remember seeing quotes from my tweets that made reference to genocide, that made reference to, you know, that were very critical of Israel. And these were cited as evidence that my presence in Switzerland would be at grave imminent risk of threatening or inciting jihadist terrorism. Jihadist terrorism were the exact words that were used. At another point, they said, this is from my recollection of what was stated to me by the translator from what the police officer conducting this hearing or whatever it was said, that I am accused of offending against Swiss law. And when they got to the part where they said, I have the right to be heard, do I want to comment on anything? I said, the only thing I want to comment on is that at no time have they described to me any offense that I have committed in Switzerland. Recall that I had arrived on Friday afternoon. I had taken a walk in the old city of Zurich at sunset, which was beautiful. I'd bought some Swiss chocolate. I went to the Victor Enox shop and bought a small Swiss Army knife. The next morning, I ate raclette. And then I walked with Valerie, and then I was abducted. So all the things I had actually done in Switzerland were probably among the most stereotypically Swiss things possible. And I was not aware that chocolate or Swiss Army knives or raclette had at that point been outlawed. So at no time did they describe to me any offense I had committed against Swiss law.
And the media smear campaign against you kept accelerating. Can you talk about then what happened, especially in the newspaper NZZ?
Right. So I didn't see this obviously till I got home, because once I was under arrest, I had no access to the internet or to anything like that. But apparently, a couple of hours after I was arrested, the NZZ published an updated version of their article, which I think we can just show for people to see. It's in German. It was published on Saturday at around 3 hours after my arrest. And the updated headline was, an Islamist was scheduled to appear in Zurich again, but now the man has been arrested. Government counselor Mario Fair speaks of a Jew hater. That's the headline. And then the article states, Abu Nima apparently managed to enter Switzerland despite the entry ban. Again, the suggestion there is I had somehow snuck into Switzerland, when in fact I entered through the airport and there is an entry stamp on my passport. And then it says, as the Zurich Cantonal Police announced on Saturday afternoon, a 53-year-old American was arrested shortly after 2 p.m. and had been banned from entering the country. The man was taken to a police station for further investigation. Immigration law measures would then be examined.
Okay, so that's Saturday. What was the next step? What was the next phase of this?
I mean, when we were in there, Dina was with me. We thought, we hoped that, okay, they don't want me in the country. My flight is scheduled for Monday anyway. If they wanted me to move it to Sunday, I would be fine with that. I'd be happy to go. That they would let me go back to the hotel, gather my things, and leave the next day. But they said that that was impossible. We fought very hard for that, but they said, no, you're going to stay in administrative detention. And
because there were no charges filed against you yet.
There were no charges. Yeah. I mean, I've not... as far as I know, I've not been charged with any kind of crime, unless, as I said, eating Swiss cheese and Swiss chocolate and buying Swiss Army knives is now a crime, in which case I plead ignorance of the law. But they said, you know, you're going to have to stay here. And so they took me. And the Swiss prison is a very surreal place. This was a new prison. It was very clinical, very bright, very concrete, very brutalist and concrete. A lot of metal and clanging, as you can imagine. It was a real prison. I mean, this was not a police station jail. This was endless corridors of cells. And I was a little bit in disbelief, but then they take you and then they say, they strip search you again, they take your clothes, and they put you in a prison uniform. And then they marched me down endless corridors, opened a big metal door of a cell, and they said, your cellmate is another Arabic speaker, another Arabic speaker. And they put me in and they closed the door.
Tell us about what it was like sleeping, eating, waking up, trying to find any sort of information about your rights or lack thereof. Describe the conditions, Ali.
I mean, I should say that during the initial phase when they were, I guess, checking me in or whatever, they did bring a doctor and he examined me and he asked me what medications I take and, you know, they listed them and I had my medications with me in my backpack and they took them and they said the prison will administer them to you. And they did do that. They'd bring it to you twice a day in a little cup. You'd have to take it in front of them. I mean, the conditions I was subjected to were the conditions everyone in that prison was subjected to. I don't think I was singled out, but it's, you know, it's certainly not, it wasn't dirty, it was clean, it was bright, but it's prison. And there's little consolation for that. I was with a cellmate, a young Moroccan man who was very, very nice. I mean, we kept each other going through that experience. It was also quite terrifying for him. He was an asylum seeker. He'd been picked up on some petty charges and he was in there. But the sense of isolation creeps up on you very quickly. And you just feel you feel completely powerless, completely cut off. And the first thing, I just felt this utter sense of like, what I was just worried about my parents, about my colleagues, about you, about everyone at EI, about my family. And I was like, I just wish I could communicate with people to let them know not to worry about me. And that was the thing that was really quite worrying at that point. The first night they brought me some food. They said, do you want to eat? I said, no. And it was really because I just wasn't hungry. But then I decided in the morning when they brought breakfast to the cells. There was no dining hall. We didn't get to go to any communal space. I refused it. And I decided I'm just not going to take any food. And each time they came to offer me food, I said, I want to know why I'm here. I've done nothing wrong. And until I can speak to my lawyer, until I can exercise my rights, I will not accept any food. And I ended up refusing 8 meals in a row. I didn't take any food during that time, except on the last day after they had confirmed that I was going to be released that day. And that was the only time I felt powerful, when I could say no to them. And I don't want to compare in any way my situation with that of Palestinians who have been imprisoned in far harsher conditions. But I thought about them. I thought about Khaled Al-Jarrad, who we'd just seen released a few days earlier, I thought about Khadr Adnan, who had waged countless hunger strikes until his last. I thought about Abdul Halim Ashkar, who had been a political prisoner in the United States. And I thought, if they can do much more under far harsher conditions, I can do this. And I got whatever strength I had, I got from them. I truly did. I thought, I have no reason to complain. People have given far more than this. You can do this. That was my pep talk.
And but you did drink water.
I did.
And as you said in a statement that you posted while you were on the plane after leaving the barbaric country of Switzerland, you said that that's because water is a right of every human being.
And that's something I had read. I mean, to give credit where it's due, I had read that in an account of a Palestinian prisoner some years ago. I don't remember who it was or if their name was even published. And if someone knows that, please share it in the comments. It may have been in a report from, thank you. I don't remember, but we'll confirm it. Tamara is saying Muadh Hamad. Yes, that's what it was. He was arrested in Spain and interrogated by the Mossad in Spain. And that's a story Tamara wrote about for the Electronic Intifada. She interviewed him. I'm grateful to her for reminding me. But he had said they offered him coffee. And he said, you don't take coffee with your jailer because then it's as if you're his friend. And but you take water because water is your right. And he said that in an interview with our very own Tamara Nassar of the Electronic Intifada. And I remembered that. I couldn't remember where it was from, but I remembered it and it stuck with me.
And you know, like, I know that all of us at the Electronic Intifada and people all over the world, you know, we're very, very worried about you. I mean, me, you know, as a Jewish mother, I was worried about you getting your medications and whether you had a warm enough blanket and, you know, what these horrible, you know, jailers were doing. And I know that we're all just very relieved that you're okay and that you're out. I mean, so maybe we can bring in John and Asa and we can kind of talk about, you know,
well, there is another yeah. I want to do that, but there is another important aspect of this that I think I want to address in terms of just giving the narrative,
yeah,
which is that there do appear to have been serious violations of my rights and procedure, and that was what happened on Sunday when I had been brought into the prison on Saturday, and that police interview or police hearing or whatever it was had been done with my lawyer, who I had appointed lawfully and legally earlier in January before I even got to Switzerland. She had the power of attorney. She was the attorney of record, so to speak. And on Sunday morning, they came to my cell, the prison guard, and said, you have an appointment, an internal appointment with the police. And I said, oh, does that mean my lawyer is here? And he said, I don't know. I just have to bring you. You have to ask them upstairs about that. I said, okay. So I assumed if the police want to interview me, they have brought my lawyer, which would be the lawful and proper thing to do since I have an attorney. She should be informed if the police are going to interrogate me. And so I went with him through the long dystopian corridors of cells. And they put you in this, there's a separation between the prison and the police side. And it's like a holding cell that has a door on one side and a door on the other side. They put you in from the prison side and they lock it. And then you sit there for a few minutes and then they open it from the police side. So it opens from the police side and there's this Swiss man there with a goatee. And he says, hello, my name is Hoffman. come with me. And he's got a couple of cops with him, and we go with them, and we go back to the office. I don't know if it was the same office where the hearing was in the first day, but it was similar to that. And there was another man there who greeted me in Arabic. And I thought to myself, oh, it's Sunday, so they could only get an Arabic translator. So they said to me, so he introduced himself in Arabic. I shook his hand thinking he's the translator. And I sat down and he said, I'm going to explain to you why we're here. I said, before you explain anything, is my lawyer here yet? And they said, no. I said, well, is she on her way? They said, no. I said, well, how are you going to talk to me without my lawyer? I was told that you're from the police and you want to talk to me, so my lawyer should be here. He said, no, we're not from the police. I said, who are you then? He said, we're from the Swiss Ministry of National Defense. I said, what do I have to do with the Swiss Ministry of National Defense? And he was speaking to me in Arabic, Egyptian. He was Egyptian. He was an Egyptian who works for the Swiss Ministry of National Defense. And he was trying to be very friendly. And he said, well, we just want to talk to you. We want to see what the problem is so we can see how we can help you. I mean, this good cop, bad cop bullshit. Like, I haven't seen a million movies. Like, I haven't read a zillion human rights reports about interrogations. And I just said to him, I have nothing to do with the Swiss Ministry of National Defense. And it's completely improper for you to come and talk to me without informing my lawyer. He said, well, we just want to help you. We want to see what this problem is so that we can find a way to solve it. I said, what problem? You can talk to my lawyer. And if you want to talk to me, you bring her here and we'll talk to you together so I can get her advice. And I mean, he said, we just want to ask you some questions about the reason you came to Switzerland. Why did you come to Switzerland? And at this point, I'm thinking back to what I'd heard the day before, that I'm going to inspire jihadi terrorism. And at this point, I'm thinking, what am I in? Is this much bigger than I thought, you know? But I held my ground. I was quite firm with him. I said to him, and I spoke to him in Arabic. I said, "Aib alek, you know, shame on you. Who do you think you're fooling? You think that by bringing some Arab, I'm going to think you're my friend and we're going to sit down and have a friendly chat?" And I turned my back to him and I said to them, "Are you going to bring my lawyer?" They didn't say yes or no. They said, well, our work doesn't really involve your lawyer. I said, okay, I'd like to go back to my cell.
I bet, and it doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what we did. They took me back to the cell. And I have to say, that was the moment I felt the most fear that it could escalate. And I started to think about, like, I thought about Julian Assange at that moment. I thought, like, they can do anything. They can make up anything. They can frame you. The way they're framing this already about jihadi terrorism and violence against Jews. And now clearly these intelligence agents have been sent to talk to me. And that's the moment I thought, does anyone know I'm here? I had no idea what was going on outside. And on the way back to the cell, I'll just tell this, you know, through one of these long endless corridors, there's a window that looks like, you know, like kind of a bank teller's window, think of it like that, with a slot under it, and on the other side of it is like a big room with desks, like a police control room type of thing. And I stopped there, and I started I started shouting through the slit. I said, I want to see my lawyer. They're trying to question me without my lawyer. I want to see my lawyer. And there was a little button, like a bell button, and I started ringing it. And they were saying, hey, you cannot do that. I said, I'm doing it. I want to see my lawyer. Then the guy comes out. He has a badge that says Teamleiter. I guess that's German for team leader, like employee of the month type of thing, but it's the cops. And he comes out. He says, what is the problem? I said, I want to see my lawyer. They told me that I'm going to speak to the police. It turns out that these are defense ministry officials, and they're trying to talk to me without my lawyer. Get me my lawyer. He said, you cannot call your lawyer. You can write her a letter. So they said, go back to your cell. We'll bring you a piece of paper and an envelope. I went back. They brought me one sheet of paper, a pencil, an envelope, and they said, you write the letter to your lawyer. I wrote it, I rang the bell, I gave them the envelope. They said, oh, do you know her address? Does she have an office in Zurich? I said, I'm in a concrete box. I don't have access to anything. How are you going to give, how is this going to work? And then are you going to just mail it? Like she's going to get it on Wednesday? They said, well, that's our system. I said, well, I have her phone number, which I had written down on the sheet giving me my supposed rights. Can you call her to come and get it? They said, that's not how our system works. I mean, the point I want to make here is that not only did they try to interrogate me without a lawyer, even though I had a lawyer on record after I had made clear that I would only meet them with a lawyer. You know, American jails are not the paragon of high standards, but you don't you can't make a phone call. You can't phone a family member. You can't contact your lawyer. You are completely cut off. And I want to stress that that was the conditions for everyone there, not just me. And that is shocking in a country that, you know, portrays itself as this paragon of democracy.
What was the process like in terms of learning about when and if you were going to be deported? What happened Monday? And then we'll bring Asa and John in.
So Monday morning, first day, I guess it was around 8 o'clock, just after I had refused breakfast, they came and they said, you have a meeting with your lawyer. And I just felt this wave of relief. And they took me, and Dina was there. And that was the first time she told me. She gave me a message from my dad, from my family, from Tamara, from everyone at EI. And she said, everyone in the world is talking about it. And there were tears of relief. I mean, when I think about it now, just that all that feeling of like isolation just washed away in that moment. And then the official from the migration office came, and, you know, the plan had been on Friday, our hope had been that they would get me out of the country as soon as possible. Once that was their decision, you know, because they told me you have a right to appeal, but appeal does not delay the implementation of the decision. So we are appealing, but the deportation was going to take place anyway. So at that point, you just want to get it done. You want to get out of there. At that point, they came, and I think by that point, they knew about what was happening in the world. And they knew how much attention this had gotten. They knew more than I did at that point. And that is so important. The solidarity, I think, really made a difference. That's a real lesson here. And then things moved pretty swiftly. There was a lot of paperwork to do, and I had to give them my ticket and my booking information. And it took them about half a day to organize the paperwork from 8 a.m. until around 2 in the afternoon. And then they took me to the airport in handcuffs, in this little cage in a police van around, I don't know, 3-4 in the afternoon, something like that, probably around 4 in the afternoon, and in another holding cell at the airport until they took me to the plane. So, you know, at that point I was just, and they didn't give me my items back, and they didn't give them all to me. They couldn't, you know, they were not efficient as the Swiss are made up to be. I got many of my most important items back. Some are still there that will be forwarded at some point. And I was just so relieved when they gave me my phone back at the gate of the plane. I could call my family and I could call everyone. And that was the moment I started to see all the messages from people. Before then, I hadn't seen any of it. And it was incredible.
It was a whirlwind, and we were all very, as I said, very, very worried. But we also knew that, you had already prepared, accompaniment by a lawyer. You had done these things in advance. That should have made the process very streamlined, and yet, of course, the Swiss authorities wanted to put obstacles in every way. So let's bring on John and Asa I really wanted to talk about the lessons that activists, journalists, human rights defenders can learn from your ordeal and kind of where we go from here. And then we want to talk about what you missed while you were in prison, because it was an absolutely historic moment.
I mean, one thing I want to say, I missed most of it. One thing I will say, we had a TV in the cell, and Abu Bakr would be very proud of me because I watched a lot of football, which he knows I'm not an enormous fan of. But Mustafa, my cellmate, liked football, and I wasn't going to argue with him. He was very sweet, and it was the only thing that helped pass the time. And there was nothing else to watch, and you don't feel like watching anything at all. It's not like you're sitting there thinking it's Netflix night. You just have no spirit to do anything. But at one point, we caught a glimpse of a news channel, and it showed the Palestinian prisoners being released off the buses. And I just felt this surge of joy. And I thought, how wonderful. And then I thought, wait a minute, I'm in prison. It's just like I'm watching
so
this
surreal.
For prison. And I'd like to be released too. But honestly, it didn't dampen my joy. That joy I felt for them was spontaneous and enormous, and nothing could dampen that.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, we missed you because I wanted to know what you thought about this weekend. I mean, we've reported through a really horrific time, and this weekend seemed like we turned a corner in that, and just it was one thing after another. There was an amazing documentary that you have to get caught up from Al Jazeera Arabic about the resistance that was incredible. But then there was the prisoner exchange, and the prisoner exchange from the Gaza side was incredible to watch. I hope we can come up with better words, but I was awestruck by it. It was like hundreds, if not thousands, of fighters. They were perfectly organized. The captives themselves looked like they were obviously treated very well. The whole event went off just as the exact opposite of what Israel said that it was going to do, and that all of these 475 days of being told what Israel's objectives were to defeat the people of Gaza, Friday it looked like the exact opposite of that. The police were out in the streets, so the government was represented. Obviously, Qassam was represented. Saraya al-Quds was there. It was a perfectly organized event. Women and children were there celebrating, cheering on the fighters as they moved from wherever they were to the place where they handed them off. Everything was just done really tight and organized, and the exact opposite of what the Israelis tried to achieve. It was a real beginning of a weekend, I think, that really underscores a major defeat for Israel. So I wanted to know what you thought of that, and we missed you.
Well, I haven't caught up with everything, but what I've seen is incredible. And the march of people going home, those images, the images of people's joy and their steadfastness and their attachment to the land is something that, you know, made us all proud wherever we were as Palestinians. It made us proud because that is the most true, most sincere, most steadfast expression of the attachment to the land and to the land itself. Even if there is nothing left, even if they destroy everything on it, people go back with the determination to live there, to rebuild, to be in their homes and their communities. And that was the best thing to come out and see. Honestly, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was truly amazing. When you think about what Israel's objectives in this war were, to return the captives through violence, that failed, to destroy Qassam. We saw them on Friday in perfect formation, totally organized, to destroy the government. The Gaza municipality is immediately out in the streets, cleaning, people painting. Just the scenes were unbelievable. And then the other Israeli objective was to make Gaza no longer a threat. And what you saw here in these pictures are people coming back, as you said, more steadfast, more resolute, more dignified and determined than they ever have been before, which was already through the roof. And so this is going to be an utter failure for Israel. And when you look at it on the other side for the Palestinians, that Qassam's and Hamas, the national movement, all the factions were in agreement on the terms that were to end the aggression. And the aggression ended, that they were to withdraw from the corridors. And this week, it didn't look clear that that was going to happen. It looked like Israel was going to renege on that. As late as Sunday afternoon in North America, there was no return happening. People were stacking up at the border, at the Netzarim corridor. There was warning shots fired in the morning and then real live ammunition shot into the crowd. And it looked like this was going to be a heinous massacre. And then within a few hours, we're seeing these pictures that just reversed all those horrific pictures we saw in November and December of people leaving with their belongings on donkey carts and just devastating pictures. So to just turn that all on its head, so the withdrawal from the corridor was also one of Hamas and Qassam and the national movement's demands. Return to the north, we watched that. In this one weekend alone, we saw examples of all four of Israel's objectives fail and all four of Hamas's and the national movement succeed after 480 days of just savage, brutal, cruel punishment. It was just unbelievable. We didn't, on top of worrying about you and trying to figure out what was going on, we didn't sleep. The Toronto Bureau didn't sleep a wink this weekend. It was just unbelievable to watch. And it was just... even from a guy from Toronto, I was totally moved. I just everything that we've watched in horror from a distance, we watched this pure joy. And the moment that they opened the corridor, it was like a rock concert or something. It was just like everybody walking. People didn't even carry things. You could see people that had like makeshift rucksacks carried on their shoulders. They had, they were like white vinyl bags. You could point those out in the crowd, and that just proved that everybody else wasn't carrying anything beyond the bag or the clothes on their backs. They were just going to return home. And on the other side in Gaza, people were painting the walls, as Tamara just showed that imagery, and like creatively doing it, because paint's super expensive, as you can imagine. So they have systems for stretching out the paint and mixing the colors so that you can get different colors out of the paints, and just cleaning everything up, cleaning the streets up, so that when people come home, they would be welcomed, even though, you know, the place, you would think, and we've been told that the place has been utterly erased. The first day, Palestinians are proving that it's not. And tonight, people are sleeping in their homes, some of them. Of course, most of the homes have been damaged or destroyed, but people are living in damaged, very damaged homes that have been cleaned up. And it just felt like such a moment. I mean, it's hard to say victory, but I don't know how else you could frame that. It was just remarkable to see. And I wish you were there to see the sights.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, Asim al-Nabi, who we just showed, the spokesperson of the Gaza municipality, you know, as well as other contributors of ours, Abu Bakr Abed, of course. You know, people were talking about how this is the first return of, you know, the next phase of Palestinian liberation.
And I could imagine that march. I could imagine that. When I saw that, I imagined them continuing to so-called Kfar Azza and Kibbutz Be'eri and Sderot and all these colonial settlements built over the ruins of ethnically cleansed Palestinian villages. And I'm certain many Israelis had the same thought.
They were very upset at what they were
Ben
saying.
Gavir, you know, he was foaming at the mouth, you know.
Crying on television, like, all that we had worked for, the soldiers said, you know, gone in a flash. And Palestinians, like, you could watch them, because you could. It was 7 a.m. was when it opened. Was when the Israelis were to leave. They announced it, it was before 7 that people started moving. But you could watch them moving forward. And when they got to the first telephone pole, a Palestinian kid is climbing up the pole, planting a flag. Mm. As they walked forward, they got to the next pole. Someone climbed up, planted a Palestinian flag. It was amazing. People bringing back their family members in whatever way they can, on their shoulders, on broken wagons. It was amazing. Yeah. There's definitely hard times ahead. Don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but this weekend was remarkable.
It was. There's a couple of actual like media clips with sound that I want to show. And then I want to talk about, the lessons that we can learn, Ali, from your ordeal, from your detention, in terms of how we can continue to protect ourselves legally, and kind of where we go from here. So let's look at a few more media that we collected from the last 24, 48 hours in Gaza. So there's Asim.
الله يا جماعة شعور لا يوصف الحمد لله اللي رجعوا أهلينا وأحبابنا الحمد لله رب العالمين يعني شعور بالسعادة والامتنان يعني إشي الحمد لله الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله.
He's saying the feeling is indescribable, the joy of seeing everyone come back.
These kids. Gorgeous. Gorgeous.
كيف بدك تهزم هذا الحج؟ تفرج عليهم. راجعين مشي. أراضيهم رجعين مشي.
كل واحد منهم خسر حد.
كل واحد منهم عاش عذاب. كل واحد منهم كان بستنى هاي اللحظة. تفرج. رجعين مشي. اللي بحكي لك باعوها، واللي بحكي لك ودوهم هون وهناك، واللي بحكي لك نطفوها، واللي بحكي لك محوهم ومحوها. تفرج. ترى أنا وياك قاعدين نتفرج مع بعض. تفرج يهبل. مفهوم الهزيمة بس عندك مش عندهم. هم بيعرفوش غير أرضهم. دبر حالك وشوف لك شغلة تاني غيرهم. أريحك، فيش إجابة. ضلكش تسأل حالك كيف بدك تهزم هدول.
شدوا بعضكو يا رفن، شدوا بعضكو. حلالي يا بلد بدي أرجع على داري. يا حلالي يا بلد بدي أرجع على داري.
That one was just beautiful. That's been making the rounds internationally.
Yes, like it's truly historic scenes, and it's an example of people power, really, isn't it? I mean, the Israel has failed to break the will of the Palestinians to actually return to their homes, and you know
they've strengthened it.
Yeah. Very similar. We're seeing very similar scenes as well, Ali, when you were on your little Swiss vacation from us. We saw very similar scenes in Lebanon too.
That's right.
So it's truly historic, and it shows that you can't beat the Palestinians, I guess. It shows that Israel failed to break their will.
That's right. And they failed to break your will to, you know, Ali. I mean, you know, there were so many statements and, you know, statements of solidarity from people all over the world, you know, saying like they don't know Ali. They don't know, you know, they think that this is going to shut him up, that this is going to shut, you know, the electronic intifada up, that we're not going to talk about Palestine anymore, that we're not going to talk about these scenes of joy and of victory and of defiance and resilience, that we're just going to, you know, slink into the corner and be quiet. Like, they don't know Ali. They don't know us. We're showing some of these statements, people by like Craig Mochaibar and Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur. All of these statements from all of these organizations, the USPCN, of course, US Palestinian Community Network, the ADC, the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, was in touch with us, you know, several times over the weekend, and they put out a really strong statement pressuring the Swiss government. There's this this petition started by the Swiss Campaign for Human. I can't remember the exact Palestinian rights. Swiss Campaign for Palestinian Rights. That's now gotten, you know, 20,000, almost 20,000 signatures. You know, and Swiss Action for Human Rights. That's it. I mean, just, you know, so there was this, like, Dr. Jill Stein, of course, you know, people were watching. We, you know, it was like we were watching two screens this whole weekend. One was, you know, everything related to Ali and worried about you and making sure that you know, you were okay. People, I mean, coming out of the woodwork, you know, people I haven't heard from in years, from all over the world, you know, asking if there was anything they could do to support. And, you know, and then on the other screen, we were watching these scenes from Gaza. And as John said, we were just hoping that you would be out, you know, and can like help analyze and discuss everything that it happened.
Well, let me say that tweet there, all those statements, but particularly that one from Hussam Shobat, you know, To have that statement from Hussam and from other journalistic colleagues, I got so many messages from colleagues in Gaza. That just leaves me in awe, because I've done nothing compared to what they have sacrificed and risked. And so I'm just like so grateful to them. I feel embarrassed about getting all this attention. But I think the lesson here is that solidarity is important, and it's our greatest weapon in these times, because they are coming after people. We mentioned Julian Assange. In many ways, he was the test case. What they got away with Julian Assange was utterly deplorable, and it showed that all the pretense of freedom of the press goes out the window when these governments feel, when the empire feels its fundamental interests are threatened. And we've seen it happen with EI, with ASA, with our colleague ASA, with the raid on his home by police. And this is happening more and more. And our best weapon is solidarity and making a fuss, not just for me, but for anyone or everyone who's targeted in this way. That's an important lesson. And solidarity is everywhere. Let me tell you one little story that really warms my heart. In the prison, in the cell, we actually had a window. It was quite a large window of sort of very thick, like almost bulletproof glass, didn't open. But it looked out onto a courtyard, an internal courtyard, and all around that courtyard were other cells. So that was the only way we could see the other prisoners in the prison. And what they would do, and Mustafa was very keen on this, was they would take the bar of soap that you got. You were issued a little bar of soap about the size of a silver dollar or something, and they would write messages on the window with the soap, and then hold up, and you were also issued a blue towel, and then they'd hold up the blue towel behind the window so that the words would be visible from the outside. And what they would do, mostly exchange messages about where they're from, and, you know, people just kind of giving each other signs, and everyone in that prison, as far as I could tell, everyone was an Arab. Every prisoner was Arab. And the vast majority, I was the odd person out, because everyone was mostly Moroccan or Algerian. And they would like write the names of the towns they're from, Wahran, Fez, Dar al-Bayda. That's what they were exchanging. And Mustafa was very pleased because I was Palestinian. So he wrote on the window that I was Palestinian and then pointed at me. And then all the other prisoners were just giving victory signs and waving. And it was really one of the most touching things I've ever seen. And so that tells you solidarity is everywhere and solidarity is important. And the other thing that, And maybe it's to talk for another occasion, but what I witnessed in that prison was the structural racism in Switzerland and in Europe. Many of the kids in that prison are asylum seekers who are not allowed to work. They want to work, and they're given a tiny allowance, and that probably leads some to petty crime. But in any case, there's a lot of structural racism. And you could see it also in the way they were talked to. I don't want to say everyone was inhumane or rude or whatever. There were some decent people who worked there, but you're still in a prison. But there were some who were you could see that there was a contempt for all of these Arabs held in cages. And I think that that was a window into the European reality that a lot of people don't want to look at. But the other thing I want to say is that, again, I don't want to compare myself to people who've gone through far harder, far longer experiences, but it wasn't something I expected. It came out of the blue. And every moment, I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't quite know what was going to happen next. And what I want to say is that if I'm proud of myself in any way, it's that I found that I was stronger than I thought. that at every moment I thought, I can do this, and others have done this before me. And there were moments I didn't know. I wasn't sure that it would end after 1 day or 2 days or 3 days. There were moments I thought it could be much longer. And I thought to myself, I'll be able to do this because I thought about those who'd done it before me. And I think that that is something that we can all find in ourselves. No one is born a superhero. People discover their strength, as the people in Gaza have had to discover their strength and resilience through 16 months of utter horror that nobody could have imagined. And I'm not trying to, again, not trying to romanticize people, but I'm saying we can find the courage to come to face what comes next, and especially if we are there for each other. I think those are the most important things I took away from this.
I think that thank you for that, Ali. I think another lesson that I think we can learn from all this and from recent events is that it does seem to be that authorities, especially in Europe, are using the specter of so-called terrorism against us increasingly, and are using those sort of laws or that sort of track of their so-called justice system to persecute journalists more and to persecute activists more. That's what they invoked with me. It sounds like they, with the talk of the, to you, which you've just revealed tonight about the somebody who was stabbed, being part of the in Switzerland, being part of the reason for the ban on you, it sounds like they're doing similar things there. And I think your case with this sort of retrospective ban on you, after you'd entered an entry ban on you after you'd entered the country, what it reminds me most of is Raad Salah, a Palestinian citizen of Israel, way back in 2011, which, you know, we reported on at the time. Palestinian citizen of Israel who entered Britain, and then after a big, for talk about human rights in Palestine and the West Bank and so forth, Palestinian citizen of Israel, an activist and a political and religious activist leader of the Islamic movement in 1948 territories in so-called Israel. He entered Britain. There was a big fuss, you could say, in the right-wing press, and then he was banned after the fact, and it was made, it was very much sort of leaked in the press by the British government that, or implied, or very strongly implied, that he had entered illegally, even though he'd entered fully legally.
They're just able to, create different loopholes around laws in order to fit some objective.
And I think that the warning with these kind of so-called anti-terror laws is that it gives them more powers to use against us, and it's something to sort of be aware of and be prepared for more.
Yeah, I mean, Ali, what is your, we're going to do a lot of kind of introspection after this, all of us at the Electronic Intifada, and people, in similar positions in independent media. What are some of the lessons that you think are important to learn, to be able to prepare for, if people are traveling, do they still have rights? Do they still have, lawyers, access to legal representation? What kind of advice can you give us?
I mean, that's a good question. They're pushing the rights to the limit. They're creating states of exception and states of emergency. And think about this. you know, 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, when the United States declared the so-called war on terror, a lot of Europe sort of mocked it and stood against it and said, we're not, at least rhetorically, I mean, they did end up going along with it. But, you know, we're not like those Americans. We believe in human rights. And Germany and France at that point stood against the Iraq war. And Europe is now more zealous and more extreme in many ways than the United States. The things that I was accused of in those Swiss documents that I was able to see during that hearing were pure thought crimes. It was saying things that they didn't like. I never incited violence against anyone. I've never called for anything like that. People know that. But it was like the ideas I express could inspire a jihadist to go out, or a likely or imminent danger of causing a jihadist to go out and stab a Jewish person. And so what does that make me if that's their logic? And so there's no, so any notion of free speech has gone in that setting. And I think we're still learning how this unfolded, but you can see there this sort of, the Zionist groups, I mean, ultimately, the Swiss authorities are responsible. I'm not letting them off the hook for what they did. And there are going to be legal actions following up on this. I don't want to get into details because I don't know all the technicalities of it. But my lawyer and colleagues are going to pursue these wrongs. I mean, I was arbitrarily detained. I was grabbed off the street for just because I was going to come and give a talk, or for whatever, you know, it was completely arbitrary. If, you know, the West paints itself as this country, we're not the type of people where thugs grab journalists off the street and bundle them into cars off to prison. But that's exactly who you are. That's exactly who you've become. And so it's easy to give up and say we don't have rights, but no rights were ever given. Rights were only ever fought for. And that means we have to fight even harder for our legal rights. We have to fight even harder for legal protections. And you have to know your rights so you can exercise them. So whether you're crossing a border, you should know your rights before you cross it, in terms of what they can and can't ask you. What they are and aren't entitled to do to you. If you're an independent journalist, you need to know your rights. I wouldn't, you know, I am so grateful that there were lawyers willing to help me, willing to be there first thing in the morning, being willing to be there as late at night as they needed to be. So legal professionals, thank you for stepping up, and more can and should step up to support independent journalists, to support activists. And I think that's the lesson here. We can't give up on our rights. We can't say, oh, this fascist machine is so strong that we just have to bow down. No, we have to keep resisting and fighting for our rights.
And it's just so striking to me that, and you pointed this out in the statement that you wrote on Twitter yesterday, that Isaac Herzog, you know, the president of Israel, was given a red carpet treatment. You know, someone who, as you said in your statement, I mean, that carpet was soaked in blood. Someone who, you know, oversaw a Holocaust, a genocide for the last 15 months, you know, was given just, you know, such a welcome by Swiss authorities. And just all we do sometimes, it feels like we're just pointing out hypocrisies of the West, pointing out the blatant double standards, pointing out the injustices of who is persecuted by a state and who is given red carpet treatment. And I think it's just so clarifying once again to see how the West, how Europe and the United States and Canada is doing everything it can in its power to once again support Israel's settler colonial genocidal project, and how Palestinians and people in solidarity all over the world are defying, you know, this power, this violence, and are walking in the hundreds of thousands, step by step, back to their land that they belong to, that they have stewarded for millennia. And, you know, that sort of defiance is so much bigger than this, like, you know, disgusting, hypocritical Western idea of you know, democracy and civilization. It is just, I don't know. I just, it continues to sharpen this kind of clarity. And seeing the scenes in Gaza that we saw really amplified that. And I think for so many people, you know, you were coming to Switzerland to talk about this resilience and this defiance and this people power and this community of solidarity all over the world who are trying, you know, to platform Palestinian voices and amplify Palestinians going through and surviving and defying this Holocaust. And the fact that they thought that they were going to intimidate you and shut you up by throwing you in prison. I mean, this is a question that I ask students when I do interviews with students. Has this repression made you afraid to speak out, Ali?
Not at all. And it's not going to. They don't know me. They do not know me. And, you know, it's the old saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I think there's truth in that for all of us and collectively. And we've come this far, and we're not going to go back. I mean, what would be the point of being silent at this point? We're going to win. I mean, we're going to win. And they fight this hard, and they resort to this repression because they know they're losing. And I'm firmly convinced of that. And the more we speak out, the more we're, you know, that's the message. The more we do this together, the more we stand up for each other, the stronger we are, the weaker they are. Nobody comes out in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands around the world, in the millions, to support Zionism and ethnic cleansing and racism. It's a dying ideology. It has no place in the modern world. And the people of Gaza already defeated it. And it's up to us to help them do the rest.
It was a thin intelligence file if they thought that it would silence you.
They did not do their homework. Yeah. Well, thank you, Ali. I know we'll have a lot more to talk about, of course, on Thursday in terms of the details of what's been happening in Gaza and the West Bank and Lebanon, of course, over the last few days. I know that you, well, you need to get some rest. So I hope that you can take the rest of the day to just rest and be with your family. And
This week I was the news, but I'm happy to go back to reporting on and analyzing the news.
That's our duty. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, thank you. I think I speak on behalf of everyone watching and listening who have been, you know, just kind of glued to their Twitter feeds, you know, waiting for any sort of update on your release, that we are so happy and so grateful and so proud of you and of each other at the Electronic Intifada and of our listeners and viewers and supporters and readers who believe in this work and in this mission of truth and justice and resilience. Yes. And
just again, thank you to everyone for all the messages. I'm so sorry. There's no way I'm going to be able to answer all of them. But
you were bad at email before.
I was. Now I mean, my inbox was like 1,000 unread messages before. It's going to be. But I really appreciate it. I really do.
And thank you, of course, to Tamara Nassar behind the scenes today, and for all of her just, sleepless. She also was working without sleeping the last 3 days, making sure that everything was.
And Tamara came to the airport with my dad at like 6 in the morning to meet me, which was just a wonderful thing. I so appreciated, and it meant the world to me to see. To be home, to be among family was the best feeling. And that was after 3 days. Imagine what it's like for those Palestinian prisoners coming home after months or years in those dungeons. If I felt such emotion after that, I just can't imagine what their feeling is. And to me, it just strengthened. And this is the last thing I want to say. It strengthened my respect for all who go through that experience, and why the cause of getting every prisoner out of those dungeons has to be always a top priority. All my respect is to them, and what little I did, I offer to them.
With that, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you to everyone at the Electronic Intifada, Tamara, Ellie Gerzon for social media, Maureen Claire Murphy for everything she does day in and day out. Every one of us on this live stream and behind the scenes at the Electronic Intifada. Thank you so much. And we'll see you Thursday. So just, less than 48 hours from now, we'll be back with our regular live stream. So stay tuned for that. And thank you, everyone. Thank you.